This episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you in part by Best Evidence subscribers. Thanks, guys. To get the latest true crime reviews and headlines in your inbox 5 days a week, subscribe at bestevidence.fyi. And now, the podcast.
They flashed a wanted sketch of the Zodiac Killer, and my heart stopped. It's like if someone had taken a snapshot of my father and put it on that wanted poster.
If I had a nickel. Can FX repeat its prestigious American Crime Story success in the unscripted space? The most dangerous animal of all takes a big swing, but Gary Stewart may get stuck on the bench with the rest of us whose dads aren't the Zodiac. Later, we're thrilled that Hustlers qualified for discussion in our cold case section since it's based on a case involving very real felony charges. And no, we don't only mean that it's criminal that Jennifer Lopez didn't get an Oscar nomination. Don't let those earbuds fall out during a reverse stag. It's The Blotter Presents, episode 135. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast that talks about how true crime is told and sold. Joining me today is Best Evidence publisher Eve Beatty. Hello again, Eve.
Hello.
So, dad's still not the Zodiac?
Nope, not as far as I know. I may have father issues, but they aren't ones that I'm working out that way.
Not any New York Times bestseller? That seems like an oversight. Let's get into our most wanted section. FX enters the limited documentary series space with The Most Dangerous Animal of All. I mean, it sort of enters the space. They premiered it on last Friday, and then they dropped all four episodes on Hulu or something.
No, they aired all four episodes in a row on Friday on FX, like one after the other, which...
Weird.
You know, it seems like that there's no better way to just sort of dump something than that way, you know?
Yeah, especially early in March. Like, what?
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, here's the case file.
It speaks a certain lack of confidence in the property.
Yeah. I think that's not unjustified. Here's the case file from FX's landing page. Quote, based on the New York Times best-selling book of the same name, parenthesis, that's a claim a lot of people make. There's a lot of different, like, charts in the Times. I'm just saying, end parenthesis. The Most Dangerous Animal of All is a four-part documentary series on FX that explores one man's search for the father who abandoned him, only to uncover the worst. He believes his father is the Zodiac Killer, one of the most infamous serial killers in American history. Executive produced by Ross M. Dinerstein, The Innocent Man, and Academy Award-nominated director Keith Davidson, The Ivory Game, The Most Dangerous Animal of All is an honest depiction of true life and true crime unexpectedly merging to upend one man's understanding of his own identity. End quote. Yes and no. I was tempted to bail in the middle of the second episode. There is a clip illustrating why. We will get to it. Eve, how far did you get into this honest depiction of et cetera and so on?
Well, I sat and watched the first two episodes. And the third episode, I put it on while I was driving so I could listen to it, because I realized it didn't matter if I was looking at it or not, that I was going to get sort of the same... That the visuals did not add enough to
the show. But Eve, the moody
show.
God's eye shots.
Well, I felt like I had a good handle on it already, because I've done 2 hours of it.
You do this for a living, you get it? Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, I sort of, like, I can look at a slow pan over an old, article from the Chronicle really any day of the week, so that didn't feel like a special thing. I'm so sorry, that's my dog.
Hey, puppy.
But, yeah, that... I didn't feel like I needed to do that. So I listened to the half of the third episode and didn't get past that. Not out of lack of interest. I found it more interesting when I was just listening to it, which is something we can get into in a minute, than when I was looking at it.
Yeah, I think this might have worked as a podcast, and it's an extremely, the structuring ends up being really weird. I have watched almost the entire thing because it was like, all right, I'm going to do enough to prep it and not be hateful and bail on it in the middle of an episode. And then if I have some time before we record, I will keep watching. I did have a little time, but like, first of all, the project quickly runs into problems because I think the FX ethos for stuff like this is kind of an American Crime Story, like atmospheric visual metaphor that at this pace and with the guy who wrote the book and who is the guy who thinks his dad is the Zodiac doing the narrating and doing these like moody poses in archives and in front of his crazy wall, I'm just not sure that that translates. Like there is kind of a standard by numbers construction manual for these kinds of things that maybe it is better to follow it. There's also a lot of writing like this clip to.
The desire to know who my father was overcame me. And that's when I decided I had to find him. I never could have predicted what I would ultimately discover. And over the next 12 years, the desire to find my father would totally consume me.
And there is a stretch in episode 3 where various family members and ex-wives, plural, are like, yeah, it literally consumes him. It's a problem.
Yeah.
Here is an issue that I had with the first couple of episodes, which I bring up with the understanding that I am not adopted. I have not given up a child for adoption. I think that this story has its own intense and legitimate dramatic heft because of that part of it, that whoever his father was, he was a piece of shit who functionally abducted his 14-year-old bride, took her to Louisiana, got her pregnant, and then was tired of the baby crying, so when putting it in a footlocker at the end of the bed was insufficient, he left it in an apartment complex. So...
I feel like you really nailed it. Because that's it. What we do know is that Gary Stewart came from... Gary Stewart? Did I just get that wrong?
No, it's Gary Stewart.
Okay. It suddenly sounded weird to me. Like, Gary Stewart. Like, I'm conflating, silver screen icons or something.
Yeah. oh, yeah. I see what you're doing. Yeah, I get it.
And, okay, he wanted to figure out his backstory because he's adopted. Sure, makes sense. It turns out it was quite a colorful backstory that made the front page of the San Francisco Chronicle because of the whole, the Lolita story or whatever you want to call it, right? You know, they call it the ice cream romance, which I'm hopeful would be unacceptable to describe now this, basically a child abduction case that ended in a quote-unquote romance. Yeah, but that's like... That's a great story. That would be a great story if you wanted to turn your sort of pursuit into your birth parents into a book. Why do you have to add the hat of, and I think you might have also been the Zodiac.
Yeah.
Why wasn't that enough? Why wasn't it enough? The arguable child rape and everything else and the jail thing and the death in Mexico City.
This was choking on his own vomit. Like, good grief. Yep. I mean... This is a crime story, and this was a national story, and I was entertained is not the right word, busied, let's say, texting with my cousin, who is the genealogy archivist in her branch of the family. Her mom and mine were both army brats together who were living on the Presidio from... 56 to 59, I think. Mm-hmm. So my aunt, who was older, would have been, I think, a freshman at Lowell High School when Van Doren Best was a senior.
Yeah.
And then I thought maybe my mother might have overlapped with Jude, the child bride, but I think she was too young, the bride. So that was like mildly interesting. I'm sort of Googling around and then texting with my cousin because my aunt is no longer on this side of the veil. But when she was, she had like a really good recall for this stuff. And I just love that it's like my parents' siblings are always sort of like ships in the night past, like, you know, the DuPont who killed the wrestler was in my uncle's class. Like, it's a very weird thing. But that, I think that was enough story. And then there's the story that Gary Stewart sort of isn't able to tell himself about why he's latching on to this tale or this idea that his father is the Zodiac, must be the Zodiac, which is if he's like an extraordinarily cruel monster, maybe that makes things more palatable somehow. Again, I don't know what the emotional algebra is here, but that there's some stern stuff as the camera is panning across this newspaper article from back in the day when baby Gary is being held up by the police. Like, anyone? Here's clip three.
I don't know where the locker idea came from.
Statement of Judith Ellen Chandler, age 15. There was no food in the house, and the baby needed formula, so I went to work as a barmaid. When I came home from work, the baby would usually be in the footlocker with the top closed. I asked her why he closed the locker, and he said he was tired of hearing the baby cry.
This clip also speaks to what seems like just short of open hostilities between Gary and his birth mother, who we heard at the beginning of the clip. This continues throughout the series, and it seems like this series might have been better as a feature documentary about, I don't even know, the shifting that memory does, the damage that lies do. But as it is, I think that it is positioned by FX as a straight ahead, like, this is an investigation into a theory about the Zodiac, and it winds up feeling like you're seeing something that you shouldn't be seeing. Do you get that feeling at all?
Oh, well, I mean, I think I was looking. I have easily 3 pages of notes just about, like, you know, that this is enabling Gary, that this is enabling that he surrounded himself with enablers and people who aren't named. I mean, what was it? His current wife, this is his fourth. It seems like he, you know, he cuts ties with anyone that this, okay, what this show is really like a masterclass in confirmation bias.
Yes. Yes.
And
at least in the first 2.5 episodes, agree.
Yeah, and well, because it's like, well, you know, the cop who believed that, you know, had some theories about who the Zodiac was said, oh, you know, it was probably this guy I met in, you know, in this mental institution. Well, I'm pretty sure that Earl was in that same mental institution at some point. So that means he's a Zodiac. Oh, you know, Paul Avery wrote about Earl. So the Zodiac sent letters to Paul Avery. So my dad's a Zodiac. It just, the level of tenuousness in the... I personally am not a huge fan of the SFPD in the bulk. You know, I think, you know, I'm friends with cops, and there are some cops that I think are garbage, just like every other police force in the world. But I, you know, I don't stand for the SFPD in any way. And claiming that they have their shit together enough to build up a conspiracy sort of complicated thing to keep anyone from figuring out who the Zodiac is both a compliment to the, you know, the bad people, the SFPD, and an insult to the good ones.
Well, this is what I always end up thinking when an elaborate conspiracy theory centers on the police pretending they didn't solve a crime, which is that's not how anything works, including, you know, police departments, PR, conspiracy theories, theories of any kind, like humans. Have you met a human? That's not how that works.
Well, and it's just like, because anybody in the SFPD who solved the Zodiac, that's their life made. That is their life, their financial security. That is everything made forever. You know, the basest sort of level, no one has a financial incentive to protect another investigator and keep who the Zodiac was on the DL.
Yeah. Particularly since the case is now, entering its sixth decade. Like, yeah. If the idea is to protect people who screwed something up, it's like, you know, Toski died. Proceed, please. let his restless shade sit down for a minute. But the it does seem like enabling, and much of the evidence is all right. The handwriting analysis until episode four seemed fairly convincing, but I didn't think the show did a good job laying out the bona fides of the examiner or the samples. The DNA comparison, which I think occurred in episode three, was patently absurd and really quite sad for Gary, because what they said was, we're 99% sure the Zodiac licked this stamp, and we can't exclude that DNA profile. And what Gary interpreted that as is, they're 99% sure my father is the Zodiac. Like, no, it's not how percentages work, and that's literally not what he just said.
And that's something that Gary has repeated again and again in sort of the coverage for this show, too. When I was reading about the stuff when I was going to write about it for Best Evidence, again and again, you know, Gary said, oh, well, you know, everyone said he couldn't be ruled out. And I'm like, yeah, but it also means that everybody else can't be ruled out. I mean, like that.
I mean, you and I can be ruled out.
Well, yeah.
But then he's holding up the picture of his dad that's been overlaid on the sketch, and it's like, okay, the length of, there's a word for this, distance between the bottom of the nose and the top lip, like it's off. The glasses are right on, because that's the glasses fucking everyone had.
Yep.
Including my dad. And
my dad.
And I had him in college, and I might get them again. Who can say? Like, right now, I can't be ruled out as being James Joyce or Sally Jesse. It depends on the day.
I'm wearing purple Sally Jesse's right now, guys. So,
yeah, buddy. So he's holding it up to his son Zach's face, and he's like, do you see the resemblance? Eh? And I'm like, I actually really don't. Like, his son actually looks a little bit like the pharma bro, which is super unfortunate. I'm sure he's not that horrible, but The kid is just sort of sneaking looks at camera, like, I mean, kid, yeah. He has his own kid. But the evidence that they're presenting, much of it is extremely circumstantial. And then enter the author of the real author of the book.
Oh, yeah.
Susan Mustafa, shooting at cans and smoking 120s. To be like, well, all evidence is circumstantial except eyewitness testimony, isn't it? And I'm like, yes? Like, whose side are you on?
I mean, Susan is very telegenic. I get why she's there in the show. She's good for a soundbite. And I did enjoy, like, the shots of her sort of standing, you know, in like a literally one block stretch of North Beach that still looks sort of, you know, golden era San Francisco and all that. Like, all that was like, was fun. And it, I mean, I felt myself perk up when she showed up, you know what I mean? Like, whatever, like, you know, when you're watching Justified or something and Raylan's not there and then Raylan shows up and you're like, oh yeah. And now I'm back in. I, you know, like she definitely, she's a lot more charismatic than Gary. And so when she would show up, I was sort of locked in more, but I don't, And then I'm like, she's smoking in the car with the windows rolled up. What year is this?
Another shout out to my grandfather.
I know, right? I can smell her hair.
I know.
But aside from being, you know, an interesting person to watch, I didn't see what she brought to, I didn't see her bringing a lot of academic rigor or anything to Gary's book or to the show.
Well, here's the thing. There's a heel turn for just about everybody in episode 4.
Should have watched.
I'm still not sure that I can recommend that people bother watching it. Because as I said before, a lot of this feels like as the episodes proceed, you're definitely feeling this tension between the talking head interviews with Gary and Jude. And she's like, I don't know where he gets that from. And he's like, from this police report. And then the book came out and she threatened to sue because there were all these inaccuracies, according to her. And it seems like he didn't even tell her he was doing the book. So she was like, yeah, no. Oh, I think she may have sued because he defamed her late husband's. Derek defamed her late husband. I'm not sure. Who was SFPD?
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Not the Humbert husband in question.
Not her husband. Yeah.
There just seemed to be a lot of issues with, like, the denouement as far as his physical abandonment as an infant is that his birth mother, who was still 15, her mother, and by the way, she had, like, escaped from a juvenile hall for wayward girls, like it was literally called that. She was returned to San Francisco, and her mother's like, well, she can come back, but she can't bring the baby. And she was 15, so
yeah,
she left the baby. Like, this story, I think, belongs in an anthology about how shittily adoptions were handled for, like, centuries.
Yeah.
But there is extreme tension and, I think, resentment and raw pain coming from him at, like, just betrayal.
Oh, that voicemail, the first voicemail, not voicemail. This is the, you know, the answering machine message he leaves her.
Yeah.
That gave me chills too. If you are my mother, happy Mother's Day. Oh my God. Maybe you're the Zodiac. Ugh.
Yeah. Like it just, I mean, and again, like I think that this does have the way that these transactions, sorry to use that word, but that's, I think, how they were seen and how they were handled for most of the 20th century, this is what you get.
Yeah.
And then he's digging into the family history, and there he is in, you know, the Gamecock state talking to this family historian about what his birth grandparents were like. And then you get this description of his birth father's mother, which is trying, I think, to set up this serial killer triangle thing in clip 4.
She had many boyfriends.
Hattie tells me when my grandfather returned from the war, they divorced and he moved to Chicago. So my father was basically abandoned by his father and was raised by his promiscuous mother in San Francisco.
It was not a very good atmosphere for a young child to grow up in. And I think that it had a profound effect on Van. It affected his whole personality.
His promiscuous mother?
In San Francisco. It sounds like a red, like, stump speech. Do you want your babies to be raised by promiscuous mothers in San Francisco?
It actually sounds like a Ted Cruz stump speech. Not for nothing. Sorry, buddy.
He's self-isolating, Sarah.
Oh, finally. At last, we can all live the dream. He's at home eating soup, ironing his dungarees. there is just so much rage. And like, whose mother actually are we talking about, Gary? Because every time he says the phrase, my mother, like that he just, like your actual mother who raised you, Leora, I can't remember.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, who seems nice.
Yeah, that she's like, you know, I understood that this was something that he had to do and he had tried to find her and hadn't had much luck and, you know, by coincidence, blah, blah, blah. But she seemed resigned to this degree that I was like, well, she's an older lady and maybe that's just her face. No, like, I think maybe Gary is a lot.
Yeah.
And here's where it lost me. And I really did plan to just like cut some clips, bail on it and be like, good luck, everybody. Hit us in the comments if you made it through the whole thing. And it was when he overlays the solution to one of the ciphers with the actual cipher. And then using both of these rubrics, he manages to find Best Junior in it. Clip 5.
You had to write the solution next to each symbol and each letter. So it's a solution plus the original puzzle. When I looked at it, I immediately saw my father's name. E, V, B, E, S, T, J, R. And it pops right here. Finding my father's name in the cipher, that's when I was convinced that my father was the Zodiac Killer.
This is an absolutely meaningless piece of evidence, giant full arm flap air quotes. Like, your father's last name was not, for instance, Sensenderfer or Rapolsky or Dickshot or Saltalamacchia or any of the other extremely uncommon names just from baseball that I can offer that might be conclusive proof of something. That's A. B, you can't use the cipher and the solution. You're just like picking, this isn't tapas. Like, what are you doing? And then the show sells him out completely in episode 4. Like, they start bringing in all these other experts to be like, actually, the handwriting's not that close. Actually, we weren't given that many alleles. Actually, his father was not in Atascadero. Actually, his father was in Austria for 4 years during the time of the murders. Actually, he lied to you, Susan Mustafa, about certain facts that you assumed he was telling the truth about and didn't double check.
Well, this really is just what happens in episode 4.
Yeah.
I'm outraged right now. Do you hear my voice is shaking? Because that means that people who don't have a podcast to do invested 3.5 hours of their finite lives into something that, you know, that the people who made the show knew to, I mean, of course, we all know it's false, but, you know, that knew to be false and then are explaining why it was false at the end. This isn't like The Usual Suspects or something where it's like a fun ride.
Yeah.
So it gets a lot. This is, oh my God, I'm so ticked right now. I was irritated because I was like, well, they gave us this garbage and it's just garbage. But if they gave us garbage and then explained why it was, you know, why it was fake at the end, that is somehow worse.
Well, first of all, they're trading on this man's, whatever it's led to, this man's obvious distress at yeah. the circumstances of his infancy. Fine.
Yeah.
Where I left off, I think I had like 7 minutes to go. I'm going to polish off the end of it just to know for sure whether they actually like try to kill him at the end, because this really is a Volt face that they show him like in church and then someone is doing a voiceover. I think Jude's sister, who's like, she's the one with the great quote, who's like, you know, ice cream romance. He was a pedophile. She was 14. Yeah. Like, thank you. She also is like, I don't know if it was a con or not. They have this retired SFPD inspector who's like, I think that on some level, you like, you have to look not at the evidence, but at what Gary really wants proven, which is that, like, he wants reasons for things that you can't prove out. And I think there is an attempt at compassion for Gary's tilting at this windmill, but as a piece of documentary filmmaking, I feel that it's really dishonest to the audience, to Gary, to Susan, who is forced to, like, re-interview sources and be like, so what he told me wasn't true. Interesting. And then the documentarians go back to Gary and they're like, we proved the following 17 assertions are bullshit. What do you have to say about that? And he's like, I guess if you like gotcha stuff, it's great. But I kind of don't understand what we were all doing here then, if the only apparent reason for all of this was to embarrass Gary.
That seems mean.
Yeah. I don't need to hang out with Gary either, but this is really a lot of time and editing and money and scheduling to be spent on pointing out that a guy who says his father was a killer is a crackpot. Like, we assumed that, like, stipulated. Do we need a whole series? This is the reason I bailed on that Hodel thing about the Black Dahlia. Like, it wasn't your fucking dad. Okay? Yeah. It wasn't.
It was nobody's dad did anything. Just
nobody's dad did anything.
Is guilty only of mundane crimes. That's just how it is.
Yeah, I just accept it. Maybe we should change the name of this podcast to "Look, it wasn't your fucking dad." Unless you're a Trump, then it probably was.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, then it was.
I mean, I assume you didn't read this book.
You know, I think that I, like, did, like, the library, you know, like, the Kindle, like, sort of checkout thing.
Right.
And I think that the writing was florid in a way that very similar to the first clip that you played, the whole, like, would totally consume me. And I just didn't have, it felt like amateur hour writing to me. And I was just not interested. I mean, because I already knew it was bullshit. But
yeah,
the writing proved it to me even more. And so I was like, oh no, I'm out. So I don't think I made it that far.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I just don't have time to follow on with this, but listeners, if you've read the book, I would love to hear from you on social media at Blotter Presents on Twitter and the Gram. You can leave a comment on the Best Evidence newsletter. That's bestevidence.fyi. Today, as you're listening to this, it will be open to all. And if you've watched all or part of this, and especially if you got to the end and you just felt during episode 4, like, wait, did someone lose a bet? Like, seriously, why is this happening to us and Gary? Again, I would love to hear from other people, because I feel like this is one that, like, a lot of TV critics wrote up and then nobody is talking about it.
Yeah.
Is that an impression you're getting, Eve, that it's like...
Absolutely. Yeah, because I was looking for coverage of it, but like before, like, the podcast, because I just wanted to see, like, how I wanted to see if I was really off base about hating it or something too. Because sometimes, whenever you catch me when I'm in a mood, and I couldn't find much with it. I could find, like, advanced stuff, like stuff obviously written prior to, like, a screener release or anything like that. Assuming there was a screener release, there might not have been.
Yeah, I mean, I asked for them and didn't get them, which means nothing. Our esteemed colleague on Primetimer seems to maybe have seen one of them, or maybe he just read the book, Aaron Barnhart. Okay. So we'll link to that in the show notes, to his review. But yeah, I have to say, if there is a follow-up to this, like a 2-hour sort of reimagining of this as a story about a man's relationship with a past that he is angry about, even though he doesn't remember it. Sure. I'm up for that. But I think tying this to true crime was kind of dirty pool in the end.
Yeah.
And It's also not well enough made to get away with punching us in the dick in the final episode.
Yeah.
So that's where I'm at with it. Listeners, if you feel differently or extremely same, either way, let us know. All right. Moving on to something I think we also will agree on in a good way. Hustlers. Here is the case file from Wikipedia. J-Lo's butt for president. That's not what it says. Quote, Hustlers is a 2019 American black comedy crime drama film. That's sick. No hyphens. Written and directed by Laureen Scafaria, based on New York Magazine's 2015 article, The Hustlers at Scores, the ex-strippers who stole from mostly rich men and gave to, well, themselves, by Jessica Pressler. The film stars Constance Wu, Jennifer Lopez, Julia Stiles, Kiki Palmer, Lily Reinhart, Lizzo, and Cardi B. The plot follows a crew of strippers in New York City who begin to steal money by drugging stock traders and CEOs who visit their club, then running up their credit cards. End quote. I adored this from the opening bars of Control by Janet Jackson to the very end. There was like... I mean, unqualified A, Jennifer Lopez really was robbed. And by the way, it should have been for Best Actress, P.S. Mm-hmm. She did a lot of lifting in that VO. It sounded totally effortless. She is great. She looks great. The only mild quibble that I have is with Constance Wu, who I think looks a little... She's supposed to be your protagonist, and I feel like she, unless she's alone on screen, you're not looking at her. Would you agree with that?
Did you read the New Yorker profile of Constance Wu?
Oh, yes, I did. Actors, well, am I right? TM. Oh my God. Well,
as you might recall from that profile, she said that she was doing animal acting, and she does this for every role. I sound like I'm making fun of this poor person. That's not nice. But so every character she plays has an animal basis. And the animal for this was a squirrel.
Yeah.
And she says that that's why you can see. And the thing is, when she said this, I was like, yeah, you know, I just, when she walks into a room, she's sort of recessed and she's looking at everything. That is true. You do see that with that character a great deal, I think.
Yeah. And then the profile goes on to compare Jennifer Lopez's animal acting to a lioness.
Yes.
Fucking A. But yeah. She's just so... I also found Constance Wu the least interesting thing in Crazy Rich Asians, which may have been by design, that everyone else was so big in that movie that they just wanted someone sort of normal at the center of it. But I like... Again, the performance is not bad. She looks great. This is clearly someone who is able to access deep wells of emotion in order to cry. But there is, if you've read the original article, and we will link to both the New York article and the New Yorker profile of Constance Wu in the show notes. If you read the original article, this person who she's based on, K.O., Rosalind K.O., mm-hmm. Rosie. It is much more, I don't know, not as squirrel-esque. I don't want to say squirrely because that's a different thing.
But we do have similar themes of abandonment as we did in our prior property. You know, this is another person who is sort of causing some chaos around her or engaging in chaotic behavior because of her fear of abandonment and her bad family stuff and all of that. And that is in the New York Magazine piece. When I read it, I think I thought to myself, oh, well, you know, everybody uses therapy speak. And I mean, I keep thinking about like sort of that apology on Facebook from Sherry Pye, the Drag Race guy, you know, where it's just like so couched in therapy speak. I wasn't taking care of myself, and that's why I hurt other people. Hurt people, and all that. But in the movie, I believed that this woman was abandoned and was really a disaster, and that's why she engaged in some of this stuff.
Yeah, I think so. And the script did an excellent job, I thought, gesturing towards those things, but not making a whole BFD about it. Like that, like very early scene where they're smoking together on the roof and she's like, where's your coat? Get in my fur.
Mm-hmm.
And like the lioness and the cub are nestling together and smoking, and it's really like, it's lovely. And also it gets that job done for you. There's a couple of other allusions to it, but they don't go too heavy on it. I was also struck by how like pro-labor this movie is. It would explain, at least in part, why my esteemed colleague and Pinko wife, Tara Ariano, was such a big fan. Here's Cardi B's 2024 platform for organized labor in clip six.
Everybody has a job here, the bouncers, the house moms, everybody but you. All you do is get your fucking dick sucked by the new bitch, you fucking idiots. Get the fucking stage fixed.
Yeah, get the fucking stage fixed. I think I'm just going to save that clip forever.
Oh, yeah.
The movie is definitely, even when it's not quite observationally correct about how a scene might go down, it absolutely is on the side of these women as not bad actors, but as people who, if they had had an ecdysiast union local, perhaps would not have had to resort to these extreme measures during a recession. I'm going to play clip seven, and then I'm going to ask you what you thought of the realism here.
Am I the father?
What?
Am I the father?
No.
Okay, then why should I give a shit? Right?
Don't you got like a babysitter or a nanny or something?
I can't afford that.
Well, you know, if you're putting in more hours instead of racing out of here all the time, right? More hours, more money, a babysitter. Problem solved. Craig's got two kids. You don't see him rushing home every time someone's got a nosebleed.
I thought it was weird for them to put this shitty to Ramona dialogue in the mouth of an Old Navy manager who absolutely would understand that his employees cannot afford childcare, as we understand it. But I still thought this was a very elegant, other than that part of it, distillation of the assumptions that are made about women who work in the who are sex workers or adjacent to sex work or anything like that. That it's like, well, why don't you just get a job in retail? Well, why don't you just get a nanny? Why don't you just? Why don't you just? I thought that the script was very good.
I don't know that he would necessarily know about the challenges of childcare if he has kids. That could be something that he places on his partner. He does not seem like the most sort of liberal guy. And if he doesn't have kids, he might not know. And like sort of the next statement that I would have expected out of his mouth, and it's something that I've certainly heard people say here in San Francisco in, you know, much nicer jobs than that. Well, you made the decision to have kids. So that means that, you know, you're going to have some other problems in your life.
Yeah. No, so, I just feel like someone who, you know, especially during a recession, someone who is the manager of retail employees who are probably going to be paycheck to paycheck would have like figured out by osmosis by now that's
one would hope
that's not how it works. But I think that's absolutely a conversation that has been had many times, and especially the Gary has kids. You don't see him running off every time someone gets a nosebleed. Like, well, right. But if he did, they'd throw him a fucking parade because it's Gary and not Mary, because that's how that shit goes. This movie, I don't know, like there are so many things that it does well that you're so used to. You're so used to seeing them done laboriously or taking too many shortcuts, especially since I reread the article immediately before rewatching the movie. I was really struck by how closely it hewed to the piece, but not in a way that chafed. And it Jennifer Lopez does a really good job explaining cons. And I think if she ever wants to like retire and just do voiceovers for like American Greed or gangsters, here's Ramona explaining how the cons started before the drugs got introduced. This is kind of a long clip, but it's processy, so I hope the gods will allow it.
Wanna go fishing?
What's fishing?
Since the crash, the club needs customers. All we gotta do is reel them in. Like anyone can own one nice suit. You want to look at their shoes, their watches, briefcases, their wedding rings. Always look for a wedding ring.
Jimmy, here's my meringue.
Once you got them on the hook, that's when we get the net.
Spencer, these are my coworkers.
What are we cheers in?
To life. Cheers.
Woo!
Cheers. Cheers.
Oh, what do we got?
Oh, you want some of it?
Colombian marching powder?
Yeah, maybe.
Let me show you how it's done.
What we should do? We should go to a club.
We should go to the strip club.
I don't know.
Come on.
It's not. Tomorrow we'll be at our desks at 9 a.m. regretting the moment that we could have gone to a strip club together. Let's do it.
Let's do it.
I'm in.
Then we steer him to the club.
Oh, yes, I do.
Where we've negotiated ourselves a percentage of his spending. And then we run up his credit card as far as we can push it. Easy breezy.
What is that? What's the site where you can watch videos that teach you various crafts? She should do that. She should do that, but with cons.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Here's me giving this idea away for free. Hey, A-Rod, call me. Let's get this set up.
Masterclass. Jennifer Lopez masterclass on cons.
Yes. Happy to facilitate in any way possible. I work cheap. She has a, like, right after this, she talks about the Justice Sprinkle part where they start introducing the ketamine mix into things. And then after that is the big sort of like Oscar bait speech about the Robin Hood arguments. You mentioned that you wanted to talk about that.
Yeah, well, just because when you watch the movie, I think that Jennifer Lopez does such a nice job of really selling that, you know, she wants to make money. She wants to buy nice things. That's not a lie. She wants to take care of herself. She wants to take care of her friends. She wants a good bag. But she doesn't feel any guilt about this because these are bad guys who've done bad things. And so, you know, big whoop. And I do not know from what I have read about Samantha Barbash and what she has said in interviews. That's the real Ramona. If she felt that way. Like, I have not gotten the impression, except maybe in sort of retconning, that Samantha Barbash was that concerned about how these guys caused the recession, and that is one of the reasons that she, you know, didn't feel guilty or anything. I think that she just didn't feel guilty because, you know, stealing stuff is fun, having nice things is fun, and it was just, you know, whatever. It was like shoplifting to her or something. And
yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, I keep thinking, like, did the movie have to have Ramona as Robin Hood? Could she just have been like, I like nice stuff?
Yeah, I don't think, I mean, I think a Robin Hood reference implies that you are, you know, giving it to those less fortunate, which That's while true. She was cutting other people in and was a den mother of sorts, not in the like official Mercedes rule. You know, mom sense in the club. And, you know, she has a daughter and stuff like that. But I think that I don't think she necessarily had any, like, you know, I'm going to give this money to a soup kitchen. Like, that level of altruism, I think, was not present and was not necessary to make her a sympathetic character who's fun to watch. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, like, I got the sense in the movie that whatever Samantha Barbash's motivations were, probably that she was aging out of a, you know, workable dancing career, that when Ramona is explaining this to Destiny, that she's rationalizing. Like, I didn't think she actually cared what the Wall Street guys did or didn't do. I think that if you asked the character, she'd mostly be annoyed that they caused a recession, thereby removing themselves from her like income stream, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
So, which again, is not necessary for her to be like, and with my ill-gotten gains, I have saved the following baskets of kittens. Like, okay, do it or don't. Jennifer Lopez interacting with Mr. Bruce, the tiny chihuahua, might have been the best thing I've ever seen. It's in the top 10. But yeah, I see what you're saying. Barbash sued the movie, though, right?
Well, yeah.
For stealing her life story, but it's unclear to me who actually she sued.
Well, so initially she sued Studio and Lopez as the primary producer for defamation. But this was before the movie came out, and I assume before Barbash saw the movie. And then after the movie came out, like the claims sort of went from defamation to you stole my life story. Because I think that, you know, Barbash isn't dumb. She realized that this is like the opposite of defamation. Like this is like, you know, this is myth making.
Yeah. Like it's really hard to argue that this performance hurt the real person in any way.
Yeah.
No.
If you want to have a little fun, do like a Google image search, like do like Samantha Barbash, Jennifer Lopez, Hustlers, and you'll realize that so many of like the sort of like iconic shots, the things that, you know, you've like sent your friends as gifts or whatever, are real shots of Barbash, where, you know, Lopez clearly really studied like how Barbash like held her purse and stuff like that, or flipped people off or whatever else. It's just, I don't know, it's just sort of interesting to see that it really, really is about Samantha Barbash and how Samantha Barbash comported herself. And so I kind of get why Barbash is like, wait, this should have been my story to sell.
Yeah, I get it. And I also wonder if due to the fact that the story is, at least in the movie, centered so much around, you know, felonious wrongdoing, do Son of Sam statutes apply to her ability to profit? And certainly, like, as the movie goes on, it starts being more and more almost verbatim the Pressler article.
Yeah.
Which is not a complaint. That was one of the best things I read in 2015, for sure. This last clip is pretty much verbatim taken from different parts of the article, and I think it says a lot about why some people responded to it.
So there was a sting.
We cannot comment on that at this time, but what we can tell you is the amount of people that were willing to talk to us was so small it was absurd.
Why?
I guess men don't want to admit what happened to them, you know, being victimized by a woman.
Well, this is one of the oldest tenets of confidence artistry, going back to, you know, the dawn of man. Is that a big part of it is that you're relying on people to be too embarrassed to tattle on you.
Oh, yeah.
So, like, older siblings know this from the time we're out of diapers. I mean, maybe. Just kidding, Dave. I may have conned you out of your allowance a couple of times. Yeah, I think that really spoke to a lot of people. But also, it's just a really well-paced, fun, flavorful, like, love letter to unionizing and ingenuity in the face of necessity. I don't know. I think it's great. Recommend. And the article, too.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, and that's the last thing that I sort of wanted to talk about really briefly was that I feel like you mentioned earlier that this movie avoids a lot of the missteps that sort of similar movies make. And one of those, in my opinion, is that the sort of the main character is the white journalist who's figuring out what's going on, you know, educated journalist who, you know, and that we could spend all day making a list of places where, you know, the central character in this story that involves people of lower incomes or people who are not white or people of different backgrounds or whatever, but the sort of our Virgil through the journey is a white middle-class person, because that's, you know, the everyman that moviegoers are going to understand. Right.
Right.
And I so appreciated that the movie did not do that, that the Pressler character, that Julia Stiles was a character. She was someone in it. And you got to see like a little bit of her life. You realize, you know, she's a human too, but it wasn't a story from her perspective, looking at these folks anthropologically. She right. was just, she was the conduit for the story. And she was sort of like, I mean, she was like the catalyst, like, oh, okay. After the story came out, you know, Ramona said this to me and blah, 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 blah. But it wasn't coming from her. And I thought that was so important. And I bet you $25 that at a certain point, someone from the studio said to somebody somewhere on the line, you know, somebody working on the story, well, how about Julia Stiles goes to the strip club and talks to them, and, you know, Jennifer Lopez tries to teach her how to strip or something, you know, like, which I guess that's Step It Up and Dance or something, isn't it?
Either that or Julia Stiles was like, please, no.
Well, I mean, I realized as I was saying that Julia Stiles is actually a really good dancer, but so that is, oh, I don't know. So that would be another reason that if I were the studio, I would probably suggest this, but just sort of be like, oh, you know, like if Jennifer Lopez is explaining to Julia Stiles how to use the pole, it's like, you know, that way it's the everyman character and the audience is learning how hard it is and all that. I bet you somewhere somebody said this stuff, that they wanted Julia Stiles sort of inserted into it more, when, and that doing that would be taking the story away from the women who it's really involved in and making it the journalist story. And I mean, even as a journalist, where I imagine that I'm the star of every story, I hate that in movies. I hate that the journalist should not be the star of the story, that everybody else is the star. It's not about you, guy who made up the lies in season 4 of The Wire. It's everyone else.
My God, that guy.
Who ended up directing Spotlight. God bless that.
Yeah,
actor,
no, he's a really good director. Know. Bless his heart.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have a certain amount of compassion for a journalist who at least that it's something that should only be in the first drafts, though, that it's like the only way I can figure out into this story is through relating it to my own experiences. Like, fine. Whatever gets you started. Fine, but this is what we call throat clearing, and no one cares, and you need to cut it.
Mm-hmm.
I just reviewed a book recently for Best Evidence that, like, the writing is amazing, but if this is a true crime book, we need to see the back of you. So yeah, I didn't even realize that I didn't miss that until you pointed it out, and that's an excellent point. And there is a little bit more of it in the article, because the, you know, Destiny keeps sort of like changing, or Rosie, whichever, seems to keep changing her mind about whether she wants to participate in it. And she, like, at the end, there's this like weird coda about how she made everything up. And she also keeps calling Jessica Pressler to just like chat, and there was just enough of their or Rosie slash Destiny's fraught relationship with this kind of attention in the story where it didn't undercut it or get too Freudian, and it didn't have to make the journalist the center of it. It had her read for filth for going to Brown and ejected from the house, and it didn't like linger on her sort of like trudging to her car and, you know, doing a sad about how a source was mean to her, like, you know, welcome to life in feature writing. So yeah, I thought that was good. And I thought Julia Stiles played it perfectly, like a couple of thinky faces, but nothing out of hand.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a good movie, and sometimes sometimes addition by subtraction, like I just think there's so many things, like we were saying, that it doesn't do that that movies shouldn't do, and that's part of its appeal also, that it knows what its story is and who its stars are.
Yeah. I love it. Everyone should watch it.
Yep, agree.
J-Lo was robbed.
Yeah. And it's not pricey right now on Amazon. HD, $3 to rent it for 48 hours, which you should do.
Yeah.
We will link it. All right. Thank you so much for coming on to talk about one ridiculous property and also another one that was ridiculous, but in the good way.
It all comes back to your parents. And if they leave you behind, you're going to be weird.
Yeah.
But if they don't leave you behind, you're also going to be weird. We're all screwed, guys.
Yeah. They fuck you up, your mom and dad.
Yep.
In local news today, bees.
Eve Beatty, where else can listeners find your work right now?
Well, let's see. I'm the senior editor at Eater San Francisco. So if you care about food, I don't do much writing about like, here's a great restaurant and it's really nice, but I do a lot of writing on more sort of processy stuff, which might be of interest to you guys. I've actually been on vacation for the last 8 days, so I'm raring to get back in there and start figuring out what's going on with coronavirus and business and really interesting class action settlement and other things. Eater, San Francisco.
Outstanding. Thanks. See you on Best Evidence.
See you there.
Coming up on The Blotter Presents, we're keeping it San Francisco with author Kevin Smokler, who's going to come on and talk about Lost Girls on Netflix and also All Good Things. That's the scripted Robert Durst thing from about 10 years ago. The week after that, it's birthday week, and I'll be taking it off, but I'll keep you posted on what's coming up after that. Until then, if you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, find us on social media, Blotter Presents on Twitter and Instagram, and of course, the Best Evidence newsletter, bestevidence.fyi. My guest has been Eve Beatty, and she's on Twitter at EveB. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.